Because adversity is often the breeding ground for development. Dive into neurointerventional stories, the uncensored interviews. Our guests, all leaders in the field of neurointervention, share the difficulties they face, the complications they have had to manage, and speak without filters on little discussed, sometimes controversial, or simply taboo subjects. Hello, my name is Nantia Sujichandrarat, and today I'm pleased to welcome Dr. Ricardo Hennel for this new episode of INR Stories. Dr. Hennel, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Can you briefly introduce yourself in a few words and some of the paths that you took to get here?
Sure. Born and raised in Brazil a long time ago. Moved to the United States after finishing my neurosurgery residency in Brazil with the idea of coming to the U.S. Back then, I read somewhere that 50% of the scientific manuscripts were published by U.S. institutions. So I decided if I want to be a scientist-driven physician, that's the place to be. So I decided to go to the United States. My plan was to spend 2 years and then go back to Brazil. And this has been 23 years, and I'm still in the United States. Found tremendous opportunities. After almost 6 years in Buffalo with Nick Hopkins and the team, and after a fellowship with Robert Spetzler at the Barrow, a lot of opportunities to develop career, happy family with my lovely wife and four kids, everybody well adapted to the United States and happy to be where I am.
I can see why it's hard to go back. Today, our theme for this podcast is the uncensored interview. So we are going to focus more on the difficulties and the complications and the things that are driving our field, the adversities that have driven our field. So I'm going to just start broadly and ask you, what is the most difficult professional hurdle that you have had to overcome in your career?
I think the transition from Brazil to Buffalo was a difficult one because you finish your chief year, you're operating high complexity pathology with or without much supervision sometimes, and then you go back to a research fellowship where you're doing surgery from non-human primates to rats. It feels like it's a step back, and to adapt to that, spend some time doing that before going back to the saddle for a clinical fellowship that is much more. When you're going through that, you have a lot of doubts in your mind to see, is this the right path? Am I doing the right thing? Is this investment of time, good or bad, away from the family, pulling wife and then a one-year-old with me on that journey? When you look back, naturally, the investment was worth, but when you're living through that, away from family, a big Italian, Portuguese family, everybody very close, so back just 20 years ago, 23 years ago, the communication was not what it is today. That definitely we improve as a world of communication over the last 20, 25 years. So that was a tough one.
I remember when I first came to the States, I used to have to buy these like phone cards to call.
How long ago was that?
I stopped counting after 15 years because it feels so long.
Yeah.
but I can totally relate to that. Yeah. Just as a side note, I actually said this to Dr. Mont Alvern during our interview. I have yet to meet a Brazilian neurosurgeon that has trained in residency in Brazil who is a bad surgeon. Was there something about the volume, some sort of training path that made you guys that way?
Very different than the U.S., but you have a lot of people in neurosurgery, that's the area that we belong, that are very science-driven. So you see people driven to neuroscience because of the science behind. A neurosurgery specifically is a very procedure based in Brazil. There's not much, with some rare exceptions of different schools, bigger schools, that you have science involved on that. A lot of that is a hands-on program. And when I trained, spine surgery essentially was non-existent. So was cranial surgery. So if we're doing 800 surgeries a year, it's about 790 craniotomies for a different type of pathology. So very cranial-based training 20 years ago, 25 years ago. Today, natural spine, as everywhere, grew, and it's 70-80% of the practice in many different services in Brazil, but a lot of hands-on experience.
You said 700-800 cases a year for a resident?
Yeah.
That is next level.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. All right. So
no working hour restriction.
Yeah, you would have to remove that to make that work. Yeah. All right. So we'll shift gear a little bit. Let's now talk, if you will, about the most difficult case that you've had to treat in the recent, let's say, months or so. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, I think it was super nice to hear that here from Isabel, the psychologist, PhD. I think it's something that I learned from Nick Hopkins and from Robert Spatzler. Nick started a complication meeting specifically to think about that and to reflect about that, because I think we learn much more when we have mistakes. I remember a case on my fellowship that I'm doing a PCOM aneurysm that I was already a neurosurgeon for many years. I've practiced in Buffalo for 2 years independent as a cerebrovascular neurosurgeon, stepped back to be on the saddle for a fellowship, and PCOM aneurysm rupture and the brain just swelled right on my face. So for a week I was down, and to hear Robert comes to me and said, why you're like this? Again, you're not yourself. I said, boss, I cannot get over the fact that I hurt this patient because the aneurysm ruptured in my hands and the handling could have been better. I said, happened to any of us. So you have to learn from that and always reflect what I would have done different on this case. And I teach the residents and fellows all the time, you have to be thinking about what you could do different. You can never do that case again. And that hurts because you know you could do better. You know you've done this before in a better way. To think about specific cases comes to my mind, a late 80s, a lady, I wrote and done a lot of flow diverter. This lady came with a sixth nerve paralysis. I said, look, this is a 5% M&M. I think we have the option of monitoring. She's 89. She's independent. With double vision, said, I cannot drive. So we treat her with a flow diverter. She had
What location again? I'm sorry.
Cavernous left carotid.
Gotcha.
Cavernous left carotid. She had a shower of emboli. Small emboli, still early. So she's 2 weeks out of treatment. I'm hoping she's going to get better. But you see this lady that she has a right arm, and unfortunately she got always small emboli, but one went right into the motor, and her right arm is weak. So right now she has the sixth nerve paralysis, and I gave her a right arm weakness. And you look at that, and I can hear many different people. Alex Bernstein said, look, you know the natural history for this. She could get better by herself. So I feel like sometimes we're so confident that you can perform the task and treat the aneurysm. It was a giant aneurysm with certain safety, that maybe when you portrayed it to the patient, maybe we're overconfident and maybe over-optimistic. Even though you say 5%, they don't really grasp what 5% means. And if you leave that alone, maybe it should be better. And that's what I think is so important, to be specific, data-driven. We got to have not only your own numbers, but as a field, I think we don't do a great job in presenting to the patients. I've had many different ideas of show a patient what is a hemiparesis mean in a video. It is much easier when you're seeing somebody else. This is what it means if you have this. Because you tell them you have a stroke, you're going to be weaker on your right side. They may not have a clear grasp of what that means. We know what that means. They don't know necessarily what that means.
But it's also difficult too, right, to see somebody who came in with acute nerve palsy and a cause to not do anything.
Not to react. Yeah.
And also, I think the data on that is, we don't have good data on that.
I totally
in a
agree.
Natural history.
So, totally agree.
On the other hand, we have data on the improvement after yes. flow diversion.
Yes.
So
yes.
It is yeah. tough. It is yeah. a tough case.
I have a colleague. She's a neurosurgeon in Canada. She also likes to describe the curse of a hybrid dual-trained neurosurgeon. They have two tools. You have clipping and you have coiling, and the varieties of endovascular treatment and microsurgical treatment. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that also creates a struggle, because if you go to the side of microsurgeon, you have a complication. Say, darn, right. if I had gone endovascular, maybe the outcome would be different, and vice versa. So, and because you know and you see and you have these tools available, mm-hmm. you become more demanding on yourself, and you have to understand that you're a human being trying to help another human being, and we all have limitations. So complication is part of that. Mm-hmm. And the best that we can do is to learn from every single complication. I'm a big fan of M&Ms. Monthly base, we're there discussing every single thing that went wrong and what can we do better. Cannot go back again and do that case, but you can always improve upon what you learned from the last one.
Right, right. Yeah, we have a lot more choices now, and the choices are only growing, which makes the decision even harder for the field, I think.
With no data to drive. That's what I think is so hard. You have 10 brands of flow diverters. Can you say they're all the same? I don't think so.
Yeah, exactly.
But how do you decide which one is better for each situation? And that's okay. Sometimes some people like Porsche, some people like Tesla, some people like BMW. Mm-hmm. But that's not a great comparison because there's no life implication on that. Yeah. I think it's very important to push. Raul Nogueira just presented a study that we did together with Phenox, comparing head-to-head. I think that's very important. And I hope to see in the future that the industry will be pushed on this direction to do more head-to-head comparison of devices or techniques. Unfortunately, on the aneurysm side, we start on the wrong foot because if you look at natural history, there are studies. Are they great studies? Again, tremendous respect for people that did those studies, but they're holes. Because when we started the field, it was not done on the proper way when 40 years ago, if you say, I'm not going to clip every aneurysm that is there, mm-hmm. we're just going to monitor this. So if you had good patient population studies, that would be driving what needs to be done. To go today with all social media, peer pressure, information out there to tell somebody you have a 6.9 millimeter on the ACOM with a daughter sac. Let's randomize you to do nothing versus treatment.
That's tough.
It's going to be really hard.
Yeah, that's tough. So maybe we can talk about that a little bit. You are passionate in data-driven science. And as you astutely mentioned, you know, it's very difficult now for young trainees coming into the field. I think even more difficult than it's been. Now that we have a lot more choices and a lot more choices make it more confusing for people with little experience. And so if you can talk a little bit about your involvement in pushing forward this data-driven practice and what are some of the difficulties that you've seen in all of this effort?
Yeah, I think it's very important to be super specific when we talk about data. I'll give an example. Early on with Flow Diverter, very good physician, colleague of ours, come and said, oh, I'm going to offer this patient this treatment with this new tool, Flow Diverter. I said, okay, what's the risk of this treatment? Oh, he said 1%. This was a giant supraclinoid aneurysm. I said, how can you quote this 1% if we know if we're doing this with any technology, clipping, stent coiling, that was the way to treat those endovascular back then, we knew the treatment complication was higher than that. So it was hard to portray that a 1% complication was a real. So we came to learn that that complication was actually way higher than that, to the order of around 10%, if you're talking about a giant aneurysm and anterior circulation, maybe even higher. So it's, I think the field is mature enough in 2023 to be more specific. When you're quoting a complication, we're working with the industry, and there are all criticisms that come from that. Oh, you're working with the industry, their data is biased. Don't disagree. They have an interest on putting the data together. That is to show that their tool works, but it's the best that we have because there's no independent, unbiased to get NIH to pay for a randomized study of stent coiling versus a flow diverter. There's no funding for that. So we have to settle for the second best, and we end up with registries that are independent adjudicated. They have good data on that. So if you look, for example, in one that I work with, a Stryker on Atlas, if you quote what is the complication rate for a Atlas-assisted coiling on anterior circulation, the overall number is 4.4%. But it's still misleading because if you're talking about a specific carotid aneurysm, that number is under 2%. If you talk about middle cerebral artery aneurysms, that number is over 8%. So you're unfair to both groups, carotid and MCA, if you are not specific. You have to be specific on this. And I think the field is mature enough that we should have this big data with good quality. It's very hard when you do a meta-analysis of anything because, with all the respect, we publish meta-analysis trash in, trash out. That's what I joke with the research fellows. But we can do patient-specific meta-analysis. So if you look at the Hermes data, that is not aneurysm-specific, but talking about a stroke, if you do patient-specific, you have good information on that because you're pulling a series of patients that were studied on the same direction. So we're working with partners in industry and partner physicians to put a group together and have 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 aneurysms that were treated many different ways to specifically define performance criteria, I think is very good for a young operator to say, okay, anterior communicating artery aneurysm, under 7 millimeter, if I treat with coiling, this should be my result. There's a variability from X to Y, but the median number is here. The average number is here. So for every location, you have guidance. Okay, my numbers need to be around here. If I'm having more complications than that, maybe I should be thinking about something different. Retrain, retool, using a different tool. So all these things, I think, can give people guidance where they should be going. I think that is still lacking. Coiling was big. Introduction 1995, 2004 is the year that we cross path more coiling than clipping in the United States. Mm-hmm. We're 20 years from that, and we still don't have this data well defined. So I think there is a role for us to put this out there.
So kind of like an issue in UCAS table, but for coiling, for stent-assisted coiling, for flow diverters, just different sort of treatments.
Correct. That's what we're thinking. And agnostic of, we don't want to get in a complicated political discussion. We don't want to get on a complicated discussion that device A is better than B or C for whatever treatment we're talking about. But to give people an idea, in the hands of as many as were involved on these clinical trials, this is the average number of complications for that specific location, for that specific size aneurysm, for that specific tool. I think it would be very interesting to have this there and give a performance criteria for new tools coming. So it is very hard when you're doing a clinical trial, and from the agency perspective, from the FDA, you go to the literature, you can find performance criteria that is very variable depending which papers you put on your analysis. So if you can be more objective in what you're measuring, what you're comparing against, I think we can do a big service to the field to guide new developers and to guide operators. Again, your performance should be in between these lines. If you're above these lines, you should be rethinking what you're doing.
Yeah. What about the ischemic side of things? What are sort of your take on that?
I'll tell you that when I came to Buffalo in 2001, that was one of the most impressive things I've seen was ischemic intervention. Because, again, aneurysms, AVMs is something that we are born in neurosurgery with. Ischemic stroke was not part of my training. And it's one of the most rewarding things that we can do as a practitioner. But it's definitely from the humane perspective, the burden on the operator is tremendous. Again, we did not plan, and we still don't have a system that is equalized, especially for those that live in two different worlds in parallel, microsurgery, neurosurgery, and neurointervention. It is very hard to be fishing a clot out of somebody's brain at 3 a.m. and have to do an acoustic neuroma at 8:30 the day after. It's no question that we're still looking for this balance for the operator's life balance. I think it's important. We didn't plan for that. My generation, you're way younger, we did not plan for that. But again, I think it's a perfect case example where in 2001 it was clear to me, if you open a vessel, the patient's going to do well. It took us from 2001 to 2014, that was December 2014 when Mr. Clean came, it took us 13 years. Imagine how many lives were sacrificed because we didn't have level one evidence. Once we opened that door, put level one evidence, that's the way to go. And that's the impact of data. If you can design a study and put this in a way that shows everybody. So today you see that. Again, it's endless. Again, the predicted growth in our market is to double the number of thrombectomies in the next 5 years. We don't have manpower for that. So this is something that you alluded to in the previous interview, the resources, what do you need to do that from the manpower perspective. But I think in your future, you'll be seeing a lot of stroke intervention. I think it's going to be very hard that a disabling stroke that's not going to get intervention. I think we're going to get better in neuroprotection. I think we're going to get better in medications to help these strokes, just like this 2B3A study just published 4 days ago in New England Journal, using tirofiban for NIH up to 5 with no large vessel occlusion with super nice results outside of TPA window. So I think you're going to be seeing this cocktail of medications, neuroprotective agents, 2B3A, with or without thrombolytic. So it's very exciting that that is a very data-driven environment. And we have that create guidelines and then massive additions to the therapy because you see the impact there and it's easy to replicate.
Yeah. I think the ischemic side of our field almost grew at the rate that our field is struggling to keep up. But, you know, to the point that you were alluding to, somebody asked me, how would I deal with like ischemic stroke becoming such a large part of neurosurgery? And to me, growing up in this generation, there was no other way.
Yes.
I'm past Don, I'm past Mr. Clean. And so this was part of our everyday life. But I think coming from the generation before that comes out, I could see how that would be field shattering and dividing. So maybe we'll shift gear a little bit. We are going to wrap up the podcast with the 4 questions that we ask everybody. If we went back 10 to 15 years, was there anything that you did that you would do differently?
As a immigrant, somebody that left his country and his family, I always have this question in my mind, what if I spent 2 or 3 years and then went back to Brazil, what would life would be? But we cannot live 2 parallel lives. I'm happy that I have a beautiful, happy family and I do help a lot of people with my work. So I think a human life is the same in Brazil, in Thailand, in the Philippines, in the U.S. So we're helping human beings and I think that's what the vast majority of us came to medicine for. So I'm always happy if you look around the number of people that we help, the impact that we made in a community with our own hands. I think that's very inspiring. So no regrets. I think I'm very happy where I am, and I think we have a lot of time still to work and do things different. So no major regrets, thankfully.
And if we fast forward 15 or 20 years, how do you imagine our field?
I think we're going to see a lot of changes. I think people joke about artificial intelligence. Jacques and I forgot, maybe it was Tudor, joking about Chat GPT.
Yeah.
I think if we can do a good job in acquiring good data, I think the processing of the data and integration of the data, I think, is going to be tremendous for the future. And I think we're just scraping the surface on the genetics of a brain aneurysm, very dear to your boss.
Yeah.
I think we'll see an impact of those much more in the next 10, 15 years. I think we're collecting all this data with not major impacts, a little bit on brain tumor like GBM. You see people surviving 5 years after a GBM surgery. So certain that 20 years ago when I started, I decided against being a tumor surgeon because I did my master's on markers of glioblastoma, and everybody was dead within a year.
Yeah.
So you start seeing this impact, and I think we'll see that on cerebrovascular. We're already seeing the rate of subarachnoid hemorrhage decreasing because people are getting educated. Different parts of the world, different penetration of quit smoking, take care of yourself, watch your numbers. But I think this will become more and more prevalent. So I'm hoping the diseases that we'll handle be different and hopefully less impactful for the population. I think that's what we're working for.
Regarding the training of future interventionalists coming out, what do you think we're not saying or doing enough for the future generations?
I think I'm a big believer in simulation. I think we passed the point that we should have specific curriculum with simulation. I think we talk about this for a while, but the simulation tools got so much better, especially on the endovascular, but also the microsurgical. I think we should have a specific curriculums for all residency, especially fellowships. There's no reason why you have to learn an exchange maneuver in a human being. No reason when your first flow divert deployment is in a human being, your first coil is in a human being. The human life is too precious for that. You can get very good in a lot of the tasks that we perform on the endovascular arena on a simulator environment. I think that should be part of our training in an organized way. It's a pity that in the United States, it's still a debate, CAST certification, who is the certifying body, who can do this, and we see people that are not trained doing procedures. And that's a pity. I think that's one part that I think as a society, I'm always worried about that somebody's going to impose upon us something that we didn't ask for. So we have to be prepared. I think we need to do it first. I think that's the best way to be prepared for that is just do it yourself.
Now, we've discussed several difficult topics. We're going to end on a little bit of a positive note. Was there any initiative, any advancement, any technological invention that you think was the most inspiring and the most impactful to you in the recent years or months even?
I'm a big fan of this new little thing called OCT. I'm involved with that, not as involved. I think hats off to Matt Gunnis specifically, not a physician, but an engineer that drove that a lot with Ajit Puri, AJ Wakalu, Demetrius Lopez, now with Vitor Pereira and Pedro Lilic. So involved on that and following that, I think we're going to be seeing vessels in a way that we haven't seen before. And we're going to have to learn how to react for the new reality, for the new environment that we're going to see. But I think we're going to understand better what we're doing. We're going to understand much better the failure mechanisms, and then the results will get better from that. And then we're going to develop new tools to address the problems that we're seeing, that all device A, B, or C is not reacting well on this situation. Device X did a much better job. So I think we'll be able to measure that better. I think if you're measuring better, you can perform better. So I'm very excited for that one in specific.
I'm a little afraid that I would have to post-process my flow diverters more. As Charles' disciple, we rarely ever post-process flow diverters. So, but I saw some OCT results. I think it was Dr. Gunnis actually that came and presented the data, and I was completely shocked.
I think we're going to see better results, because if you look around, there's a 20% failure rate. Maybe this non-communicate malapposition is the explanation for why same ophthalmic aneurysm in one patient occlude and the other one, there's flow on that. Right. So I think it would be very interesting. And maybe it's just a smoke. But again, you're measuring. Is there a difference? No, there's no difference. I'll move to the next one. So,
thank you very much for your time, Dr. Hanel.
No, I appreciate that finally we managed to get together, because, again, last time we tried, we're running in different directions. But it was a pleasure to talk to you.
Pleasure to see you again.
I'm so glad that our future is in great hands. It's so nice. People talk about new generation, they don't like working hard. I say, guys, I'm biased. I'm optimistic by nature, but I see a lot of young people really caring about, again, at your young age, at the stage of your career, you're thinking about greater good. How can I give back to my country? Talking about U.S., talk about Thailand. And this is everywhere. Again, all the residents that I interact with, interviewing, and what gets you worried, what do you think you can do different. So all this spirit of giving back, I think, is much more prevalent today than it was when I was at your age, and looking at my peers that were very focused on me. I think it's, if you focus on the world, the me component will come. You don't have to be focused on yourself. If you focus on the greater good, I think it makes the place better for everybody. So I'm optimistic.
Thank you very much. Thank you.